Welcome to another episode of Good Night Tanzania with myself, Zaba. Good Night Tanzania is a podcast meant to help ordinary South African people understand a little better where they're from historically, so that we together can come to understand the present. On all social media platforms, I am Mzamo Simone, and the podcast is Good Night Tanzania. I hope you'll like, subscribe, and comment with your views so that I may know what you think, of course. Let's see what's on the menu today. The history of the Earth is a concept that eludes our very human imaginations. Billions and billions of years are no small feat for people who only manage to live, you know, a maximum of a century. People who are, you know, caught in the experience of living everyday lives, people who have to struggle to feed their bodies, people who have to, you know, struggle against oppressive social structures, people who, you know, live in the throes of popular media, and so on. And so to think about the billions and billions of years, you know, that geologist Silinde Wuhle told us, you know, that the Earth has been around for, is quite a tricky one. But even so, there have been attempts over time, over the course, the millions of, you know, of years that humans have been around, and especially, you know, the recent 10,000 years specifically, there have been people who have been asking these questions. These are people who have been scientists, you know, of varying levels of genius, innovators in their various ways, people who, you know, with a daring spirit, who want to go out there and ask those questions, teachers and so on and so forth. They have craned their necks trying to make sense of, you know, the void that is the 4 billion years. You know, what content, what stories does it have to offer to people who live today in that sense? And so today, this is obviously evidenced by the existence of so many disciplines in university departments. Archaeology, for example, we have geology, like I've just said. And we also have history, like written stories, obviously, of the natural, you know, living world, you know, of mountains, of, you know, the fauna and the flora of different landscapes and so forth. And so we've also had people who have taken incredible risk to their lives by leaving their, you know, their domestic spaces or the environments that were very familiar to them, and went out there into the real world to, you know, to ask questions about what other forms of, you know, like what other landscapes exist out there, and how can we go about sort of collating all these into, I suppose, a compendium or a collection that can easily be, you know, like accessed by many people. I mean, we can think of the story of Charles Darwin and his voyages in the 19th century, and how these have come to shape, I mean, modern science and how what we think about evolution. And so there have been people who have traveled the world, I guess, then to explore the world. And so today, I guess, I want us to think about what people have, you know, have written about South Africa during the course of their travels, if there are any, you know, individuals like that. And then if there are, what have they written, and how has it ultimately come to affect, you know, the ways that people who are South African have, you know, creatively imagined what it means to be South African, have creatively imagined the past of South Africa, and so on and so forth. And so today, I will be joined by a person who will help us do exactly this. And this is Ian Glenn. Ian Glenn is a professor of the University, emeritus professor at the University of Cape Town. He studied at the Universities of Natal in Durban, where he did a BA in English and politics, and then an honors in English at the University of York in the UK, where he did a bachelor in philosophy, and then at the University of Pennsylvania for a Master of Arts and finally a PhD. His particular research interests are media in the New South Africa, political communication, audience studies, media technologies, and the literature of exploration and environmental media. It is certainly an honor for us to be joined by such an accomplished scholar. Ian, welcome to Good Night Azania, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much indeed for inviting me. What an interesting topic, and I hope we're going to have some interesting conversations about it.
I certainly hope so too. Thanks again. But before we get into the crux of the matter today, we have been, visited by a lot of scholars who have had, considerable lengths, as researchers. And it's been very interesting for us, obviously, to interact with people's different motives for becoming researchers. Can you just look back to, your career as a researcher and possibly share with us the highlights in that career and why you decided to become a researcher in the first place?
I think I'm very lucky to have had a career as a university teacher. And I think one of the good things about a career as a university professor is it combines three jobs into one. First, you're a teacher. You're a person who supervises research. You teach. You try and share the latest discoveries in your discipline. And secondly, of course, there is the research side of things. And if you're lucky and you're in a good place with good students, there's a kind of synergy between your own research and your own teaching and what students are pushing you to find out or the questions students ask. And the third thing, and I think I was lucky in being, if you like, at the right place at the right time, was that academic life has developed a lot. Disciplines change. And I was at the University of Cape Town at a time when I came in as a lecturer in the English department, teaching English and American literature and South African literature. And then we set up a Center for Film and Media Studies, and that's been very exciting. And that's now, I think, one of the most exciting centers at the University of Cape Town. It's got a lot of staff who do wonderful research across social media into film studies, who work also on the creative side of things, who help students make films, help students do radio and so on. And I think it was interesting that wasn't traditionally a university discipline, but I think it's become a very interesting area of what's going on in a world where social media in particular take up so much of our time and energy and effort.
Thank you for that. I think that's certainly very interesting. And because also, media is a very powerful sort of form of soft power in that sense. And I think, it's incredible work that, you guys were doing. I think you helped establish that department, didn't you?
Yeah, I was certainly one of the people who moved from other disciplines, and I was the director for, I suppose, most of the first decade of its existence. I think I was director for 9 years of the first 12 or so. And it was exciting, and it was a young, and I think it's still a very young and vibrant department. And that was a great privilege and a great pleasure to be in this, be in at the foundation of something new and help to get it going and help to get it established.
And keeping that in mind, I'd just like for us to consider natural history. I mean, the world is very long, like I said in the introduction, and so it obviously transcends the experience of humanness and the existence of humans. I mean, there's also been a point in the past where, dinosaurs, lived out a considerable sort of life on the earth as well. I'd just like for you to give us a sense of what natural history is and where travel writing sort of fits into that sort of discursive practice, if I could even put it like that.
Well, I mean, let's step back and say with exploration, the voyages of exploration and discovery, the people who were working in science of the day suddenly say, this opens up all sorts of new possibilities. You mentioned Darwin, who travels and finds new animals or new species, and how did they come to exist, and what governs the process of natural selection and so on. In South Africa early on, some of the first people are astronomers, because clearly if you come to the Southern Hemisphere, you can see things that you can't in the North. You have botanists, you have Linnaeus sitting in Europe and saying, go and discover the whole world of botany. What plants exist elsewhere? You have Buffon in France saying, what animals exist elsewhere? What birds, what mammals can we find elsewhere in the world? And as these people go out, of course, they also start saying they're people who live differently from us. They're people who don't behave the way we do. And that, of course, then opens up, as you were mentioning earlier, the whole discipline of anthropology. And of course, anthropology is closely linked to questions of race, superiority, difference. So the whole question of the Enlightenment, where we start saying, well, it doesn't look as though the world with the particularly religious or Christian assumptions of God created the earth and this is the way things are, suddenly your sense of the universe and man's place in it changes quite dramatically. And I think that's one of the big things that happens in the Enlightenment. And it's one of the big contributions of these people who come not only to South Africa, but of course go to the United States or South America or Australia, that they're reporting back and changing man's sense of himself, changing our perception of where we fit into the universe.
And can you just give us a sense of the kinds of individuals or the names of individuals who show an interest very early on in, you know, the centuries that have come before us in South Africa and the kinds of literary productions that they've, you know, been engaged in? I mean, you've mentioned that they're astronomers, they're botanists and other sorts of naturalists. Who of these have been those people who are necessarily interested in exploring South Africa through, you know, the lens of, you know, their scientific takes to reality or to history?
Well, my own, you know, I've got a list, and I'm referring to the article that I think drew you to ask me to come to this. And this is a chapter in the Cambridge History of South African Literature, and it's a chapter on 18th century natural history. I mentioned there Peter Kolb, who was German, because one of the things that's interesting about this is a European enterprise. It's not just the English or the French or the Dutch. You have people who come to South Africa from all over Europe. You have two Swedish botanists. You have Sparman and Thunberg. You've got astronomers, De La Caille, and later you have other astronomers. Kolb was also an astronomer. You have Patterson, who was a botanist. And the person who's interested me the most, and I think probably the most important of the figures, is a Frenchman called François Le Vaillant. He was born Vaillant, but renamed himself Le Vaillant to sound more aristocratic. And I wrote a whole book about Le Vaillant and published in 2017 called The First Safari, because for me, what happens in Le Vaillant's case is he comes here to write science, but he also writes a journal of his travels that becomes very influential. It starts getting people excited about the idea of hunting, for example. And we haven't talked about hunting yet, but if you looked at books about South Africa or from South Africa in the 19th century, the most popular books were hunting books. They weren't Olive Schreiner and literary books. They were books about hunting. South Africa became the place where you hunted. So to me, Le Vaillant is the most exciting because he writes six volumes of books of birds of South Africa eventually, but he also writes a travel history or a story about coming to South Africa, which is so exciting that it inspires hunting narratives, it inspires all sorts of other kinds of writing. So this is a case where natural history moves over into travel writing, and then that becomes very influential. It starts shaping how people see South Africa. But Le Vaillant's also interesting because he's a case where someone has read Rousseau, and Rousseau, the philosopher, looks at Rousseau sits in Paris and he reads what all these travel writers who've gone to Africa say. He reads Sparman, he reads all the other people, and he starts saying, well, and this is the particular question for Rousseau, is man naturally good in nature? In other words, is civilization the way we know it in Europe actually a good thing? And of course, for a lot of people, that was taken as a given. We are more civilized, we superior, we are the model of what man should be. And what Rousseau does is he questions that. He says, is European civilization or European society not deeply corrupted? And he, and it's not only Rousseau, but the people who come to the Cape, people like Kolb, people like Le Vaillant, look at what they call the Hottentots. That's become a word we regard as derogatory or or racist, but he looks at these people and says, actually, their behavior towards one another is more honorable than the behavior of Europeans towards one another. So maybe man in nature is actually better than man in our Western society. So one of the things that travel does is it starts making Western society look at itself more critically. It starts making Western society say, but are we the best? Maybe we've gone wrong somewhere. And I think that's the very profound kind of reversing of the gaze or reversing of our assumptions. And I think Levant is probably the one writer who takes the lesson of Rousseau most sort of thoroughly to heart. Rousseau has a wonderful passage somewhere where he says, we don't have a philosophy that travels. What did he mean by that? He meant that if we try and understand man in Europe and we try and take that those assumptions or that kind of philosophy in Europe, it doesn't work in Africa or it doesn't work elsewhere in the world. Maybe the behavior of people is different. We need to understand things differently. And of course, you can see that's really the beginning of anthropology. How does this society work? How does that culture work? What's different about them? And in what ways are they better or more humane or more honorable than we are?
And before we get to anthropology and those intersections between that discipline and travel writing, can we just quickly unpack, you know, for listeners who might not necessarily be aware of the Enlightenment, what it was and, you know, what changes sort of in society, in, well, Western European society sort of characterize, you know, this particular period for it to be named the Enlightenment and the kinds of figures. I mean, you've spoken at length about Rousseau, but other figures as well who are associated with, you know, this particular period who were prolific in the kinds of thoughts that came out of that period and how beyond just Levayan and all these other Gordons, Barrow and all these other naturalists, how they inform their work and how they're also informed by the work produced beyond, well, I suppose you've also shared how this has been done, but I just also just would like to get through the Enlightenment for people who might not necessarily, you know, be aware of what you're talking about.
Look, it's a big idea and there's lots written about it, but you know, some of the key things we've touched on a little bit already, you upset the idea of a religiously ordered world where Western man is at the center. You start looking critically and comparatively at things. You don't take it for granted that your own cultural assumptions or bias are the best. So there's also this notion of making man at the center of the universe. It's no longer a divinely ordered universe where man has a particular place. You start critically re-examining that. And of course, you can see how a discipline like astronomy or archaeology question the notion. The Bible says the world is 6,000 years old. Well, all these new discoveries are throwing that into a very critical light, or throwing a critical light on that and saying, no, hang on, it doesn't look as though that's right at all. So what the Enlightenment does is, of course, it also then starts questioning political power. What, you know, who says that the king should have the right to rule? So in one sense, the Enlightenment leads you to the French Revolution, because what are the nation of human rights? What rights should we have? Should the king have absolute rights over this, or the aristocracy have certain rights? So in a way, we're all the heirs of the Enlightenment. When we talk about our rights, or when we talk about certain kinds of constitution, or when we think comparatively about the way in which societies work, or to the extent that we've moved away from a notion of absolute belief in a certain religion, to that extent, all that is the Enlightenment legacy. Now, you might say, well, that's a bad legacy, or it's a very mixed legacy, but that's very much the legacy that these people are part of. It becomes this attempt to order the world through Linnaeus, through a certain kind of, you know, mastery of the of scientific nomenclature and scientific classification of the world through Darwin, whom you've already mentioned. So the Enlightenment becomes this modernizing movement, this movement of understanding man, but looking critically and self-critically at the way in which we behave.
which obviously I think was also borrowing from the pre-Socratics, right? And that, you know, that scientific fervor in the philosophical enterprises, right? But I also would like for us now to get into the, you know, disciplinary nature now of or intertextualities between anthropology and travel writing, and which came first, and how, you know, one was born of the other, and what kind of relationship they've sort of maintained over time.
That's a very good and a very tough question, and you know, I've been writing about that. You know, one of my arguments is that people like Kolb and Leviant are very much the first anthropological writers. Now, of course, you know, anthropology as a discipline, a fully fledged discipline that is taught in universities and so on, is very much, you know, only occurs, you might say, well, in the early 20th century. But if you go back and look at the way in which Leviant tries to describe, say, this people he meets, the Gonaqua, who are, I suppose, halfway between the Khoi and the Xhosa, he tries to describe them systematically. And people who came out from Europe often had lists of things you were supposed to describe. So you were told, you've got to look at this, you've got to look at this kind of behavior, you've got to talk about their belief systems, you've got to talk about the way they behave. And Leviant also, for example, brought back a whole lot of objects. So if you look at his travels, there are pages and pages of his illustrations of, for example, weapons or cooking implements or musical instruments. So you bring back what, you know, anthropologists would call material culture to talk to people in France, or to explain to people in France the way people behave. But of course, in one sense, I think to me, the key moment is that drive to be anthropological is a drive to not share the assumptions of the local colonizing culture. Because what Leviant does is he takes a big distance from the local Dutch authorities. And Leviant's a very interesting case because biographically, just to throw in this, he's born in Suriname. His parents had eloped from France. So he grows up in a place where people speak Dutch. And I think that gave him a big advantage. When he came here, he could understand the Dutch settlers. And I think a lot of the Swedish visitors or other visitors couldn't do that. So Leviant, for example, is far more critical of the colonists. He predicts the great trick. He says, these people are tough. They're racist. They're not going to listen to the governor and the colony. They're going to break free at some point. Nobody else sees that coming. He sees that coming well in advance. So I think the fact that Leviant also then says he learns to speak with the Khoi, he learns to talk to them. So he has interesting exchanges with them as well. But at the whole time, he's got that impulse of, you're very critical of what the colonists say. So for example, if you read South African history about the move towards, you know, how the settlers go into the interior, and you read Leviant is very angry about it. He says, it's appalling what's happening. The settlers are stealing cattle. They're killing people. They're behaving in a very racist and you know, brutal way. So he's one of the first big critics of colonial expansion. And I think from that point of view, we also get this notion of these visitors are, if you like, outsiders. They don't share the worldview or the interests of the colonists. They're not interested in making money or, you know, getting land here. They're interested in seeing the way things are. So I think often they're very valuable observers because they're outsiders. And in a sense, that's at once their weakness and their strength, because they sit here and they can look critically. And in that sense, if you ever did English literature, you know, one of the first texts about Africa that most people used to read was Heart of Darkness by Conrad. And Conrad, in a way, is in a very similar position. He comes to Africa to work for the, you know, sort of company in the Belgian Congo, but he's not sitting here and trying to make a living in the Belgian Congo and exploit things for money. He's the insider-outsider. And I think Leviant was in a similar position, and a lot of the other early explorers were. They weren't going to stay here forever. They're not insiders. They're not settlers. They have this kind of dual status.
And of course, people, you know, understood, you know, within the context of the times they live in, right? And so all the ambiguities around people's, you know, conduct is conditioned by the experiences of the period they live in. But I'm interested now in the kinds of receptions that such, I mean, you've already hinted at this in your previous answer, more generally, but I'd just like for us to be more specific, because the earliest explorer or sort of travel writer that you mentioned, you speak about in your paper is Peter Kolb, who was active between 1675 and 1726. Who was a German astronomer. And this is obviously, this coincides with the establishment of the Cape Colony in Cape Town, the peninsula, right? And mm-hmm. and so what kinds of responses does Kolb and others who follow him sort of get from the locals? And what are the varying degrees of, you know, of evaluation that these travel writers also, you know, make of the sites that they find beyond just, Le Vaillant. And I'm just interested in other people's also, you know, perceptions of the Dutch colony that existed at the time.
That's a very good question about, you know, to what extent do South Africans, are South Africans concerned about the way in which other people see them? In other words, Le Vaillant is widely read across Europe. He's the most translated writer about South Africa till Nelson Mandela. I mean, he's read in German and French and Italian and, you know, and Russian. I mean, there are all sorts of translations across Europe of Le Vaillant's work. But is he much read in South Africa? And I think the answer to that is probably no. I mean, I think a few people do. But remember, you're talking about a small colony. You're talking about expensive books. You're talking about a place where there's certainly not much of a reading culture. You know, and I think even now, if you look at it and say, okay, someone writes a devastating expose about something in South Africa, how many people would be reading about it locally? And of course, even among the Dutch colonists, I think you probably wouldn't have had that many. Among local people of color, you're looking at a population which has very low literacy rates. You know, so one of the questions that I think you're interested in, and I think your readers should be interested in, is, well, what about the people that are being described? How are they reacting? What about the local koi and the Xhosa that he's going to meet? What do they make of all this? How does this influence them? And I think there might be stuff we don't know about local reception or local reading. But of course, a lot of the people who do read Le Vaillant are very angry because he's saying such harsh things about the colonists. So even now, when I write about Le Vaillant, I had some quite harsh reactions from local readers who say, no, the colonists weren't like this. White South Africans didn't behave like this. Yet, you know, Le Vaillant was setting this down, 250 years ago. So from that point of view, that it's still an ongoing question of there are still political stakes. When Le Vaillant says, the land was taken from us in this way, he sounds like someone, who belongs to the EFF. And of course, for a lot of us white South Africans in particular, this is unsettling. We don't want to hear this. So the question of how people reacted to someone like Le Vaillant in South Africa, I think is a really good question. I don't think we know enough. I think that certainly some people here would have read him or been interested, but this is an expensive book published in Europe. It's affecting how people in Europe see South Africa. It's not, I think, having much reverberation locally.
And I suppose, this kind of reporting from Le Vaillant is, it sort of moves away from the myth of an empty continent, right? Where people like the AfriForum, would argue that the Boers arrived at around about the same time as blacks of Africa, who were, coming in from the north, whereas they were coming in from the south. But I'm also interested now in the place of this work of Le Vaillant, of Gordon, of Barrow, and so on. Now, in the context now of professional history and critical analysis, what have scholars over the years, I mean, we have the benefit of hindsight in the sense that so many people have done so much work before us, and we are in a position now to collate it and synthesize it before we can move on and sort of ask questions of what needs to be done now. So what have people said in formal university departments and other, interested parties? What have they said about these works and how meaningful and useful they are, as Look, members of the South African archive?
Look, I mean, that's a wonderful question. But once again, I would say you need to, I'm not a historian. You know, I sort of blunder onto various territories or disciplines because I can't help it. But if you look at what people like Nigel Penn or Muhammad Adhikari have said about the San, I think you'll see that Leviant, in a way, and someone like Barrow as well, write very angrily because they can see the process of colonial brutality, almost in some senses you could say close to extermination. That process is going on, and that brutality is evident to them. And they, if you like, are reporters. And there's a very interesting passage in Leviant where he says, you know, I don't want to talk about this, he says, because to think that things like this are happening in a country that says it's a Christian country, that it's an advanced country, it's outrageous. And he sounds almost like he's got post-traumatic stress disorder from what he's seen. So Leviant, I think, recognizes the horror of what's going on. You know, once again, you could look at someone like Conrad in the Congo 100 years later and says, this is terrible. I'm seeing terrible things happening. And I think if you look at the recent work, you know, and I make this point somewhere else, that Nigel Penn and Muhammad Adhikari publishing in things like Journal of Genocide Studies. So in one sense, of course, white South Africans or the settler mythology has always wanted to deny that. We don't want to think that we sitting in a place that we won by blood and by exterminating or chasing or killing people or driving people off their land. So from that point of view, it's a shocking thing to have to confront.
And now to just move on to the question of South African literature, you opened with, you know, the point you've made elsewhere about Olive Schreiner, and, you know, she's understood as the, you know, the first substantial writer to come out of South Africa. And you challenge this, arguing that, you know, this sort of blocks us from, you know, looking at other works that have come before this. And by doing so, we are then sort of shying away from, you know, the works of travel writers. And I think, obviously, given, you know, what you've said about, you know, the denialism of, you know, a ruthless past in relation to, you know, to whiteness in South Africa and, you know, the control of resources at the expense of, you know, of other people's livelihood and just dignity, you know. And so it's not very surprising to me, but that there would be an erasure of these works and, you know, sort of moving the goalpost or the beginning point, in big quotation marks, to you know, later in the 19th century. And so how have you found that travel writing has, you know, impacted South African literature from, you know, the point that the late 17th century until, you know, the 21st century?
This is a big topic. And I think one of the things that's happened is that people are looking harder at that early writing. I think you have people now, but also people who've got interested in that early period. You know, so you have, look at more recent writing that's gone back, like, you know, Jam Coetzee and Dusklands goes back to one of the early pioneers. You have recent stuff like Willem Anker's Red Dog, where he goes back to Conrad Bass, who's an 18th century figure. So I think people are going back and reimagining those early days. But once again, you know, it's understandable why white South Africa picked Schreiner and Story of an African Farm. It's the first settler literature. And if you look at someone like Leviant, who only spent something like 4 years in South Africa, or you look at other early writers who are not here for that long, then clearly they don't share the same concerns as, you know, of being in South Africa and what it means to try and build up a South African identity. So I don't want to say Schreiner's a worthless or a useless writer. What I'm trying to say is we need to look at that longer picture, because that longer picture is actually, in a way, more interesting, because South Africa is more central to European ideas or central to Europeans' notions of its own identity when people like Leviant are writing, because they're influencing Diderot, they're influencing Rousseau, they're influencing the idea of what is human nature, is human nature good or bad, what kind of society can one have. Those discussions, I think, are more powerfully influenced by people writing from South Africa or writing about South Africa than they are when Olive Schreiner's writing. So Olive Schreiner to me seems quite a marginal figure. And one of the ways I try and, if you like, push this is say Schreiner's only translated, I think, into Afrikaans and not into European languages. Le Vaillant is translated across educated Europe. So he's a far more influential figure in saying, what kind of society is there in South Africa? What kind of brutalities happen there? What kind of excitement is there? And as I said earlier, one of the if you like, negative or one of the complex parts of the heritage is the hunting narrative. Because if you look at Le Vaillant, I won't say he glorifies hunting, but for him, the hunting is part of exploration, because you can't describe your bird or your hippopotamus or whatever until you shoot it. So Le Vaillant has lots of writing and lots of illustrations of the hunt. He's the first person, for example, who takes a giraffe skeleton back to Europe. So, you know, now here, you know, this is what he's famous for. Here's this guy who's brought back this weird and wonderful creature, and the skin and the skeleton of this thing are standing in the zoo, the King's Zoo in Paris. So everybody knows this because he has this amazing creature that one would never have dreamed of. So the king in France, who's a keen hunter, has a map made about Le Vaillant's travels. And at the center of the map, you have Le Vaillant himself illustrated. So for the European imagination, the hunting, the exotic animals, all that became a very big deal for them. So it's not just the social commentary, it's also the notion of what kind of nature do you have there? You have this wild and exciting nature, which I think makes people long to come to Africa. And of course, that's still why people want to come to Africa. You still want to go on safari. You still want to go and see the Big Five. You still want to, you know, see these things you can't see anywhere else.
Would you argue that the idea of a safari, which becomes, you know, very crucial to the formation of a national culture in the 20th century, right after the Union of South Africa, do you think it necessarily dates back to, you know, the days of Le Vaillant? Or do you think that necessarily as it exists today in the form of the Big Five, you know, and Kruger National Park and so on and so forth, do you think it necessarily dates back to those intellectual productions or to the work of national imagination that was undertaken by the Afrikaner nationalists?
Look, you know, what is it? You know, this is, I've got written a whole book called The First Safari, where I try and look at this and start saying, you know, in my view, and, you know, I'm a Le Vaillant fan, so you were to take it as someone who's writing as an enthusiast. My view is,
okay,
Le Vaillant says, okay, here's this thing. When you go to Africa, suddenly, and he says, as he comes over Solari's Pass, it wasn't called that then, he says, for the first time in my life, I felt free. Here I am in nature. I'm a man who, and it's that sense of exploring, that sense of discovery, that sense of being out of the shackles of normal society that he portrays as this amazing positive experience. And it seems to me that it's that feeling that I think is very important. And of course, part of Le Vaillant's thing is it's not just about seeing things or shooting things. It's about how it changes you. How does it change you to be in this place where, you know, you're meeting interesting, different people, where you are actually, you know, discovering things about yourself, maybe, where you're at risk in some way. So it seems to me that the notion of the safari or the notion of discovery and exploration is there very much from Le Vaillant on. You know, and I think, you know, I've written a whole book where I try and link up Le Vaillant and his idea of the pleasure of companionship on safari, the pleasure of discovering things. And I think those are the crucial elements of what, you know, goes into safari, and not Afrikaner nationalists. You know, I don't think Afrikaner nationalists, I don't think we're very interested in the notion of safari. I think they're interested in hunting maybe, but I don't think the notion of a safari, you know, safari is not the same thing as going to the Kruger Park. We can, you know, this is something I'm working on at the moment, so I'm interested in it, but it seems to me that the notion of a safari as a kind of voyage of discovery and self-discovery is very much the legacy of Le Vaillant, I would say.
Okay. Given the fact that you've spoken about sort of emendations to, you know, Western consciousness, as, you know, said on by, you know, the intellectual productions of travel writers, you know, sort of presenting their work, you know, and framing it within a scientific and, you know, objectivist sort of point of view. What does this necessarily then mean about the standpoint of Europe then at the time when these writers were going back. And I'm thinking about Europe in relation to its own past at the time as well. Because many, you know, archaeologists have argued that the human race has existed as hunter-gatherers for millions of years, and transformations, you know, of their industrial sense, you know, moving, you know, from stones to iron and things like that, you know, all occurred very quickly and within the last 10,000 years or so. So what does this study then present about the kind of background that had produced these people and the kind for them to have such an impact on their society?
Look, it's a very it's a very big, interesting point. But it seems to me that, you know, maybe if I can just go back to some extent and pick up the question about how do people see these, you know, see the local people. And one of the things is, I think that their viewpoint is very political. They understand what's happening as a process of, you know, invasion, a process of colonization. And it's very interesting because Diderot meets Gordon. And he asks Gordon about the Hottentots and are they backward and terrible people? And Gordon says, no, what's happened? And he gives him, you know, this description. Then Diderot writes an essay in a book called The History of the Two Indias. And it's regarded as such a seditious, disruptive book that it's banned in a lot of Europe. So, you know, the question of what is banned in South Africa, this book is banned. And there's a wonderful description. I just want to read you a little bit that I quote in my book on Levant. And this is, he urges the Khoikhoi to armed revolt. And I'm just going to read you. This is Diderot, right, me translating him from French. Okay. Flee, unhappy Hottentots, flee. Go deep into your forests. The ferocious beasts living there are less formidable than the monsters of the empire under which you will fall. The tiger will perhaps tear you to pieces, but he will only take your life. The other will rob you of your innocence and your liberty. Or, if you still feel courageous enough, take your hatchets, bend your bows, let poisoned arrows rain on these strangers. Let there be no one left to take the news of their disaster to their citizens. But alas, you are too trusting and you don't know them. So that's Diderot imagining the meeting between the Dutch colonizers and the local Khoikhoi. And he says, the smart thing to do, kill them all. Don't let anyone know you've done it. Just, you know, get rid of them all immediately. So that's reimagining the colonial encounter. And, you know, this is a Westerner writing, but writing very critically about the West's imposition on Africa. So, you know, that to me is part of the Enlightenment genius, if you like, that it actually turns our normal assumptions upside down. That's not the way we in our history book look at, you know, Van Riebeck landing and the people in the interior welcoming them or whatever. This is a very, you know, skeptical view of what the white colonization has meant or European colonization has meant for Africa.
And now, well, you've certainly, you know, painted a very colorful picture about travel writing in South Africa. And for listeners who want to, you know, really take up this genre and explore it, to, like, you know, because you have also said, you know, that people have shown very little interest in the discipline because, you know, it sort of rudely challenges their political assumptions, you know, about the South African past, you know, and, you know, in an attempt to argue for their present privileges. And so what research is currently being undertaken in this discipline and how can, you know, average people, you know, accountants, doctors, and, you know, people who aren't necessarily rooted in the academy or the humanities, how can they access this work?
Give another punt for my book called The First Safari, which I think for Levant is the best general, easy introduction.
Okay.
You know, one of the lovely things that has happened now is there's a wonderful availability of historical texts online. Now, you know, a lot of them would be translated into English, so you can certainly go and read them. And, you know, Levant is a good read. I mean, you know, there is a historical Van Riebeck Society edition, which I and several other people did, which has got lots of footnotes and explain things. That's the first part of his journey into the interior. So there's a Van Riebeck Society volume on Levant. The others, one of the problems is there are no good texts of Kolb, for example. Kolb wrote too much. He wrote at great length and there's no authoritative text. So one of the problems is there isn't a good text of Kolb. And I would say for people who want to understand this. I would say Devant is the easiest read, the best read, but you can go and read Sparman. Sparman was very influential. And Sparman is a much less, I think, engaging writer. He maybe exaggerates less than Levaillant. But, you know, you want to understand what it was like to travel in the interior and, you know, stay over at Caledon in the warm baths and go and visit people. You'll get a sense of that. But I think the more critical, the more exciting work, maybe then you get with Barrow, you get with Levaillant, you get with slightly later writers. So it is a tricky thing to find that critical strain. Just one other thing, just to go back. These writers, people like Levaillant, also influenced quite an interesting genre. And I wrote an article about that, which was published last year, called the captivity novel. Now, one of the interesting things is they're novels which are very well known in American literature, which are called captivity narratives. And these captivity narratives originally start with people who are captured when the Red Indians, the Native Americans, raid a settlement or there's a fight, and the parents of a child will be killed and that child will be taken into captivity. Then at some point, 10 or 20, you know, that child escapes or is taken back to the people who are sort of taken back to the colonizing culture. And then they write this thing. And usually it's with a strong religious overtone. Well, it was God's will that I should be captured and I should recount what happened and so on.
Uh-huh.
But what's interesting in South Africa, this genre takes quite a different spin, if you like. In South Africa, that genre typically happens when someone is captured by, for example, the Xhosa. But when they're captured by the Xhosa, what emerges is not, oh, the terrible Xhosa. It's, oh my goodness, look what the British are doing to the Xhosa. Why are people fighting the Xhosa? Or in An English Boy at the Cape, the young man gets captured by various groups. And each time he's captured, he sees the good in that group and he starts looking critically across all the groups. So in other words, these critical early writers who were skeptical about the claims of Western, you know, superiority, start writing at the time. And they were also influenced by people like Dr. Philip, the missionaries. They start saying, well, hang on, who are the religious, well-behaved people here? You know, and who can we really look at to get a true sense of what's going on in South Africa? So you start getting quite a critical look. And once again, these people are very much not in the tradition of a Shriner. They're very much looking at South Africa and saying, hang on, if we look at British invasion, if we look at what's happening to South Africa, don't we see things rather differently? So I would say that what starts happening is these travel writers start influencing imaginative writing. And of course, I think that trend, as I've already mentioned, you get people like James Coetzee, you get Willem Anker, who are now writing, or Andre Brink's done it with Instant in the Wind. You get people trying to reimagine those early encounters critically. And I think all those reimaginings owe something to those early travel writers.
Well, thank you so much, Ian, Professor Glenn, for first of all coming to Goodnight Sasanya, definitely an honor, and for your very colorful and, you know, inspired, you know, analysis and, you know, exposition of travel writing in the 19th century. I think if people haven't learned, hello, yes.
I wanted to add something. Sorry, there is a book coming out, and I should have mentioned this. Two of the great experts in this area are William Beinart and Saul Dubow, who are former South Africans who teach in, or have taught in the UK. And they are, between them, have produced a book which is about early South African scientific work in early scientific work in South Africa. And that book is coming out from, I think, Cambridge University Press this year. So I would urge people to, if they're interested in this topic, I think that's going to be a big contribution to this field. Lots of people have worked in this field. People like the late Patrick Harries were working in the field. So there's still a lot of work to be done here. And if you are a young historian or a young literary scholar interested, for example, I'm doing something myself on Levaillant and Gordon and their collaboration in bird names. Levaillant, Gordon asked Levaillant to comment on all the drawings he'd done of birds. And what did that collaboration mean? So there are lots of interesting collaborations that I think need more work. Sorry, so I just wanted to throw that in and say that there is more interesting work coming.
Do you know what the book title is? Or is that
no, but I'm sure people just look at under Beinart, B-E-I-N-A-R-T. N-A-R-T and Dubow, D-U-B-O-W, they'll find that book coming out later this
year. All right. All right. All right. Well, again, thank you so much, Professor Glenn. I really have enjoyed your contribution, and I hope, you know, the listeners will find it as insightful.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me. What an interesting initiative.
Pangirari, Musa, never get Pangirari. Indeed,